This is the I'm beginning the eighth section of the recording of A Philosophy of Freedom, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path by Rudolf Steiner. This is chapter 10, Freedom, Philosophy, and Monism. Simple people who acknowledge as real only what they can see with their eyes and touch with their hands also require reasons that are perceptible to the senses for their moral lives. Such people need someone to communicate the grounds for action to them in a way that is understandable to their senses, and they will allow these grounds for action to be dictated to them as commandments by a person whom they consider wiser and mightier than themselves, or whom they acknowledge for some other reason as a power over them. In this way, as principles of morality, arise the principles of family, state, church, or divine authority that are mentioned in the last chapter. Those who are the most limited in their horizons put all their faith in some one other person. Those who are somewhat more advanced allow their ethical conduct to be dictated to them by a majority, state, or society. They always rely on powers they can perceive. Those for whom the conviction finally dawns that these powers are basically human beings as weak as themselves will seek guidance from a higher power, from a divine being whom they nevertheless endow with sense-perceptible qualities. They let the conceptual content of their moral life be communicated to them by this being, once again, in perceptible ways, whether the God appears in a burning bush or dwells in a bodily human form among humans and audibly declares for their ears what they should do and should not do. At the highest ethical stage of development of naive realism, the moral commandment or moral idea is separated from any entity foreign to oneself and is thought of hypothetically as an absolute power within oneself. What people first understood as the outer voice of God, they now understand as an independent power in their inner selves, speaking of this inner voice in a way that equates it with conscience. But with this, the level of naive consciousness has already been left behind, and we have entered the region where moral laws become independent norms. They then no longer have a bearer, but become metaphysical entities that exist through themselves. They are analogous to the invisible, visible forces of metaphysical realism, which does not seek reality by way of human participation in it through thinking, but imagines a hypothetical reality added onto experience. Extra-human ethical norms always appear as accompaniments to this metaphysical realism. Such metaphysical realism has to seek the origin of morality in the area of extra-human reality. There are various possibilities here. If we assume an entity conceived of as having no thought of its own and operating under purely mechanical laws, as must be the case for materialism, then this entity will also produce out of itself, by purely mechanical necessity, human beings and everything associated with them. The consciousness of freedom can then be only an illusion. For although I consider myself the creator of my action, what operates within me is the matter of which I am composed, and its inner processes. I believe myself to be free, but actually all my actions are merely results of material processes underlying my bodily and spiritual organism. This view holds that we have the feeling of freedom only because we do not know the motives that compel us. Quote, "We must emphasize that the feeling of freedom depends upon the absence of externally compelling motives. Our action, like our thinking, is necessitated." End quote. Another possibility is to see a spiritual being as the extra-human absolute behind phenomena. We would then also seek the impulse for action in such a spiritual power. We would regard the moral principles in our reason as an expression of this being in itself, which has its own particular goals for humanity. To the dualist of this persuasion, moral laws appear to be dictated by the absolute. Human beings, through their intelligence, need only discover and carry out the decrees of this absolute being. To the dualist, the moral world order appears as the perceptible reflection of a higher order standing behind it. Earthly morality is the manifestation of the extra-human world order. In this moral order, it is not human beings who are important, but the being in itself, the extra-human entity. Human beings have to do what this being wills. Edward von Hartmann imagines the being in itself as a divinity whose own existence is suffering. He believes that this divine being created the world so that through the world it might be released from its infinite suffering. Von Hartmann, therefore, regards human moral evolution as a process whose purpose it is to redeem the divinity. Quote, "The world process can be brought toward its goal only through the construction of an ethical world order by reasoning, self-aware individuals. Real existence is the incarnation of divinity. The world process is at the same time both the passion of the God who has become flesh and the path of redemption of him who was crucified in the flesh. Morality, however, is cooperation in the shortening of this path of suffering and redemption." End quote. In this view, human beings do not act because they will it, but have to act because it is God's will to be redeemed. Just as materialist dualists make human beings into automata whose actions are merely results of purely mechanical laws, so spiritualist dualists make human beings into slaves to the will of the Absolute, parenthesis, because they see the Absolute, the being in itself, as something spiritual, in which human beings do not participate with their conscious experience, parenthesis. Freedom has no place either in materialism or in one-sided spiritualism, nor has it a place in metaphysical realism, which infers something extra-human as true reality, but does not experience it. For one and the same reason, naive and metaphysical realism must both logically deny freedom. Both see in human beings merely executors of principles that have been necessarily imposed upon them. Naive realism kills freedom through subjection to the authority of a perceptible being, to a being thought of as analogous to a percept, or finally, to the abstract inner voice that it interprets as conscience. Metaphysical realists who merely infer something extra-human cannot acknowledge freedom because they see human beings as determined mechanically or morally by a being in itself. Because it acknowledges the validity of the world of percepts, monism must acknowledge the partial validity of naive realism. Anyone incapable of producing moral ideas through intuition must receive them from others. To the extent that humans receive their ethical principles from without, they are, in fact, unfree. But monism ascribes equal significance to ideas and to percepts. Ideas, however, can become manifest in human individuals. To the extent that human beings obey impulses from that side, they feel themselves to be free. But monism denies any validity to a merely inferential metaphysics, and therefore also to impulses to action deriving from so-called beings in themselves. According to the monistic view, human beings can act unfreely if they obey perceptible external compulsion. They can act freely if they only obey themselves. But monism cannot acknowledge an unconscious compulsion lying behind both percepts and concepts. If one person maintains that another's action was unfree, then the first must show the thing or person or situation in the perceptible world that occasioned the action. If the assertion is based on causes for action lying outside the world that is real to the senses and the spirit, then monism cannot accept such an assertion. In the monistic view, human action is part unfree, part free. We find ourselves unfree in the world of percepts and realize within ourselves the free spirit. For the monist, ethical commandments, which the merely inferential metaphysician must regard as expressions of a higher power, are human thoughts. For the monist, the ethical world order is the imprint neither of a purely mechanical natural order, nor an extra-human world order. It is entirely the free work of human beings. Humans have to carry out their own will, not that of a being outside them in the world. They realize their own resolves and intentions, not those of some other being. Monism does not see behind an active human being the goals of an external world executive who determines human actions according to its will. Rather, to the extent that they realize intuitive ideas, human beings pursue only their own human goals. In fact, each individual pursues his or her special goals. For the world of ideas is expressed not in the human community, but only in human individuals. What emerges as the common goal of a human collective is only a result of separate deeds of will by its individual members, usually a few select individuals whom the others obey as authorities. Each of us is meant to be a free spirit, just as each rose seed is meant to be a rose. Therefore, in the realm of truly ethical action, monism is a freedom philosophy. As a philosophy of reality, monism rejects metaphysical, unreal restrictions on the free spirit. Just as it recognizes the physical and historical, (naive, realistic, restrictions, on the naive person. Because monism does not regard human beings as finished products who reveal their full being at every moment of life, it views as inconsequential the argument over whether a human being as such is or is not free. Monism sees an evolving essence in humans and asks whether on this path of evolution the stage of the free spirit can be attained. Monism knows that nature does not release human beings from her arms as ready-made free spirits, but leads them to a certain stage. From this, as still unfree beings, they must develop themselves further, to the point where they discover themselves. Monism understands that a being acting under physical or moral compulsion cannot be truly ethical. It considers the passage through automatic actions following natural drives and instincts, and the passage through obedient action following ethical norms, as necessary preliminary stages in morality. But it also understands the possibility of overcoming both transitional stages through the free spirit. Monism liberates a truly moral worldview, both from the inward fetters of naive ethical maxims and from the outward ethical maxims of speculative metaphysicians. Monism cannot eliminate these naive ethical maxims, just as it cannot eliminate the percept. But it rejects the outward maxims of speculative metaphysicians because it seeks within the world, not outside it, all explanatory principles for the illumination of world phenomena. Just as monism declines even to think of cognitive principles other than human ones, it also decisively rejects the thought of ethical maxims other than those applying to human beings. Human morality, like human cognition, is conditioned by human nature. And, just as other beings will have a different understanding of cognition, so they will also have a different morality. For the follower of monism, morality is a specifically human quality, and freedom is the human way of being moral. That's the end of Chapter 10, the Addenda to the New Edition, 1918. 1. One difficulty in evaluating what has been presented in the last two chapters is that readers may think they have encountered a contradiction. On the one hand, the discussion mentions the experience of thinking, which is felt to be of universal significance, equally valid for every human consciousness. On the other hand, it is noted that the ideas realized in moral life, which are of the same kind as the ideas worked out in thinking, are expressed in an individual way in each human consciousness. But if we feel compelled to remain at the level of this quote-unquote contradiction, if we do not recognize that a piece of the essence of human beings is revealed precisely in the living contemplation of this actually present contrast, then we shall be able to see neither the idea of cognition nor that of freedom in their true light. For those who think of its concepts as merely borrowed, abstracted from the sense world, and who do not give intuition its full weight, what is claimed here as a reality remains a mere contradiction. For those who understand how ideas are intuitively experienced as a kind of self-sufficient essence, It is clear that when we cognize in the world of ideas, we live our way into something that is the same for all human beings. But that when we borrow intuitions from that world of ideas for our acts of will, we individualize an element of that world through the same activity that we develop in the spiritual conceptual process of cognition as something universally human. What appears as a logical contradiction, the universal formation of cognitive ideas and the individual formation of ethical ideas, becomes, when it is beheld in its reality, a living concept. Here lies something characteristic of the human entity. What can be grasped intuitively in the human being moves back and forth as in a living pendulum between universally valid cognition and individual experience of the universal. For those who cannot see one half of the pendulum's movement in its reality, thinking remains a merely subjective human activity. For those who cannot grasp the other, all individual life seems lost in the human activity of thinking. For a thinker of the first kind, cognition is an unintelligible fact. For the other, moral life. Both will contribute inadequate notions of all kinds to the explanation of one or the other, either because they do not actually grasp that thinking can be experienced, or because they misunderstand it as a merely abstracting activity. 2. Materialism is mentioned on pages 164 and 165. I am well aware that there are thinkers, such as Tsihin, mentioned above, who do not call themselves materialists at all, but who, from the point of view put forward in this book, must be labeled as such. What matters is not whether people claim to be materialists, because for them the world is not limited to merely material existence. Rather, what matters is whether they develop concepts that are applicable only to material existence. Those who say our action, like our thinking, is determined, express a concept that applies neither to action nor to existence, but only to material processes. If they thought through their concept to the end, they would have to think materialistically. That they do not do so is merely a result of the inconsistency that so often comes from thinking that is not carried through to the end. Today we often hear that science has abandoned 19th century materialism, but actually this is not true. It is simply that at present we often fail to notice that our ideas apply only to material things. Nowadays materialism is veiled. In the second half of the 19th century it showed itself openly. The veiled materialism of the present is no less intolerant toward a view that grasps the world spiritually than was last century's admitted materialism. But materialism today deceives many into thinking that they can reject a worldview involving spirituality, because after all, natural science has long since abandoned materialism, in quotes. That's the full end of chapter 10. Chapter 11, World Purpose and Life Purpose, Human Destiny. Among the many currents in humanity's spiritual life, we may follow up one that may be described as the overcoming of the concept of purpose in areas where it does not belong. Purposefulness represents a particular kind of sequence of phenomena. It is only truly real when, in contrast to the relationship of cause and effect in which an earlier event determines a later one, just the opposite happens, and a later event has a determining effect upon an earlier one. This only happens with human actions. Human beings perform actions of which they have previously made mental pictures, and they allow themselves to be determined in their actions by those mental pictures. With the help of a mental picture, what comes later, the action, has an effect upon what came earlier, the actor. Yet the detour through the mental picture is absolutely necessary for a purposeful chain of events. In processes that break down into causes and effects, we must distinguish percepts from concepts. The percept of the cause precedes the percept of the effect. If we could not connect them through their corresponding concepts, cause and effect would remain simply side by side in our consciousness. The percept of an effect must always follow the percept of a cause. An effect could have a real influence on the cause only through a conceptual factor. For the perceptual factor of an effect simply does not exist before the perceptual factor of the cause. Anyone claiming that a blossom is the purpose of a root, that the former influences the latter, can do so only with regard to the factor in the blossom that can be established by thinking. At the time of the root's origin, the perceptual factor of the blossom does not exist yet. A purposeful connection, however, requires not merely the conceptual, lawful connection of the later with the earlier, but the concept, the law, of the effect must actually influence the cause by a perceptible process. But we can observe a concept's perceptible influence on something else only in the case of human actions. Only there, then, is the concept of purpose applicable. As we have repeatedly noted, naive consciousness, which gives validity only to what is perceptible, seeks to transpose the perceptible even to where only the conceptual can be known. It seeks perceptible connections in perceptible events. Let me read that again. It seeks perceptible connections in perceptible events, or if it does not find them, in dreams, it dreams them up. The concept of purpose, appropriate to subjective action, is well suited for such dreamed-up connections. Naive persons know how they bring about an event, and conclude from this that nature will do the same. They see not only invisible forces, but imperceptible, real purposes in the purely conceptual connections of nature. Human beings make their tools for a purpose. Naive realists have the Creator construct organisms according to the same formula. This false concept of purpose is disappearing from the sciences only very gradually. To this day it still works quite a bit of mischief in philosophy, where the question is raised as to the extra-worldly purpose of the world, of the extra-human destiny, and, consequently, also the purpose of human beings, and so forth. Monism rejects the concept of purpose in all spheres, with the single exception of human action. It looks for laws of nature, but not purposes of nature. Purposes of nature, like imperceptible forces, are arbitrary assumptions. From the standpoint of monism, purposes of life, if not set by humans for themselves, are likewise unjustified assumptions. Only what a human being has made purposeful is purposeful, for it is only through the realization of an idea that purposefulness arises. But the idea becomes effective in a realistic sense only in human beings. Therefore, human life has only the purpose and direction that human beings give it. To the question, what kind of task do human beings have in life? Monism can answer only the one they set for themselves. My mission in the world is not predetermined, but at each moment it is the one I choose for myself. I do not enter my life's path with fixed marching orders. Ideas are realized purposefully only through human beings. It is therefore invalid to speak of the embodiment of ideas through history. From a monistic point of view, such phrases as, quote, history is the evolution of human beings toward freedom, unquote, or, quote, the realization of the moral world order, unquote, and so forth, are untenable. Advocates of the concept of purpose believe that if they relinquish this concept, they must also abandon all order and unity in the world. Here is Robert Himmerling, quote, as long as there are drives in nature, it is foolish to deny purposes there. Just as the formation of a limb in the human body is not determined and conditioned by an idea of this limb hovering in the air, but by its connection with the greater whole, the body to which the limb belongs, so too the formation of every natural creature, whether plant, animal, or human, is not determined and conditioned by an idea of it hovering in the air, but by the formative principle of the greater whole of nature, which lives itself out and organizes itself purposefully. End quote. And again in the same volume it is called Atomistic des Willens, volume 2, quote, the theory of purpose claims only that despite the thousand discomforts and distresses of this creaturely life, a high purposefulness and planfulness is unmistakably present in the forms and evolutions of nature, but a planfulness and purposefulness that realizes itself only within natural laws, and cannot aim at a sluggard's world in which life would face no death and growth no decay, with all of the more or less unpleasant but finally unavoidable intermediate stages. If opponents of the concept of purpose oppose to the miraculous world of purposefulness that nature reveals to us in all areas, a laboriously assembled heap of partial or complete, imagined or real unpurposefulnesses, I find this just as silly. End quote. What is meant here by purposefulness? The coherence of percepts into a whole. But since laws, ideas, that we find through our thinking lie at the base of all percepts, the planful coherence of the members of a perceptual whole is precisely the conceptual coherence of the members of a conceptual whole contained within this perceptual whole. Saying that animals or human beings are not determined by ideas hovering in the air is a skewed expression, and the view condemned in this way loses its absurd character as soon as we correct the expression. Of course, animals are not determined by ideas hovering in the air, but animals are determined by an inborn idea that makes up their lawful being. Precisely because this idea is not outside the object, but works within it as its essence, there can be no talk of purposefulness. Precisely those who deny that natural creatures are determined from without, whether through an idea hovering in the air or an idea existing outside the creature in the mind of a world creator, is in this context completely irrelevant, must admit that such natural creatures are not determined purposefully and planfully from without, but causally and lawfully from within. I construct a machine purposefully when I bring its parts into a relationship that they do not have by nature. The purposefulness of the arrangement consists in my having set the operation of the machine as its idea at its base. In this way, the machine becomes a perceptual object with a corresponding idea. Natural objects are just such entities. Whoever calls a thing purposeful, because it is formed according to law, might just as well apply the same label to natural objects. But this kind of lawfulness must not be confused with that of subjective human actions. For a purpose, it is absolutely necessary that the effective cause of a concept, in fact, the concept of the... For a purpose, it is absolutely necessary that the effective cause be a concept, in fact, the concept of the effect. But nowhere in nature can we establish that concepts are causes. The concept always proves to be merely the conceptual link between a cause and an effect. In nature, causes exist only in the form of percepts. Dualism may talk of world purposes and the purposes of nature. Where a lawful linkage of cause and effect communicates itself to our perception, the dualist may assume that we are seeing only a faint copy of a connection in which the absolute world being has realized its purposes. For monism, any reason to assume the existence of world purposes and purposes of nature falls away, along with the assumption of an absolute world being that cannot be experienced but only inferred hypothetically. End of chapter 11. Addendum to the New Edition, 1918. No one who has thought through this discussion in an unprejudiced way can conclude that in rejecting the concept of purpose for extra-human facts, I have placed myself among the thinkers who, by discarding that concept, enable themselves to interpret everything outside human action, and finally, that too, as only a natural process. This should be clear from my portrayal of the process of thinking as purely spiritual. If the concept of purpose is rejected here even in relation to the spiritual world lying outside human action, it is because in that world something is revealed that is higher than the kind of purpose that could be realized in humanity. And if I say that the thought of a purposeful destiny for the human race, conceived on the pattern of human purposefulness, is false, I mean that individual humans set themselves purposes, and the outcome of the total activity of humanity is composed from these. This outcome is then something higher than the purposes of individual humans that are its parts. That's the end of the addendum. Chapter 12. Moral Imagination, Darwinism and Ethics. Free spirits act out of their impulses, that is, from intuitions chosen by thinking from the totality of their world of ideas. The reason that unfree spirits separate particular intuitions from their world of ideas to make them the basis of an action lies in what the perceptual world has given them, that is, in their previous experiences. Before coming to a decision, unfree spirits remember what someone did or recommended or what God commanded in such a case and so forth. Then they act accordingly. Free spirits have other sources of action than these preconditions. They make absolutely original decisions. They worry neither about what others have done in their situation nor about what they have been commanded to do. Purely conceptual reasons move them to select a particular concept from the sum of their concepts and translate it into action. Their action, however, belongs to perceptible reality. What they perform there will thus be identical to a quite specific perceptual content. The concept will have to realize itself in a concrete, individual event. But as a concept, it cannot contain that event. It can relate to it only as any concept relates to a percept, for example, as the concept of lion relates to an individual lion. The link mediating between a concept and a percept is the mental picture. For an unfree spirit, this link is given in advance. Motives are present in advance as mental pictures in consciousness. When unfree spirits want to do something, they do it as they have seen it done, or as they have been told to do in this particular case. Authority, therefore, works best through examples, that is, through the transmission of quite specific individual acts to the consciousness of unfree spirits. A Christian acts less in accordance with the teachings than with the model of the Redeemer. With regard to positive action, rules have less value than they do for the restraint of particular actions. Only when they forbid actions and not when they command them to be done, do laws take on universal conceptual form. Laws concerning what unfree spirits should do must be given to them in quite concrete form. Clean the street in front of your doorway. Pay your taxes at just this rate at tax office X, and so forth. The laws forbidding actions take the conceptual form, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. But these laws, too, affect unfree spirits only by their appeal to concrete mental pictures, such as that of the corresponding secular punishment, torments of conscience, eternal damnation, and so forth. As soon as an impulse to action is present in the form of a general concept, for example, thou shalt do good to thy neighbor, or thou shalt live so as best to further any well-being. Then a concrete mental picture of the action, the relation of the concept to a perceptual content, must first be found in each individual case. This translation of concept into mental picture is always necessary for a free spirit, who is driven neither by a model nor by fear of punishment. Imagination is the chief means by which human beings produce concrete mental pictures from the sum of their ideas. Free spirits need moral imagination to realize their ideas and make them effective. Moral imagination is the source of a free spirit's actions. Therefore, only people who have moral imagination are really morally productive. Simple moral preachers, that is, people who spin out codes of ethics without being able to condense them into concrete mental pictures, are morally unproductive. They are like critics who can rationally discuss what works of art should be like, but cannot themselves produce anything at all. To turn a mental picture into a reality, moral imagination must set to work in a specific field of percepts. Human action does not create percepts. It recasts already existing percepts and gives them a new form. To be able to transform a specific perceptual object or group of objects in accordance with a moral mental picture, one must have understood the laws of the perceptual picture to which one wants to give new form or new direction. That is, one must have understood how it has worked until now. Further, one must find the method by which those laws can be transformed. This part of moral efficacy depends on knowledge of the phenomenal world with which one is dealing. This knowledge must therefore be sought in a branch of general scientific knowledge. Hence, along with the faculty for moral ideas and imagination, moral action presupposes the capacity to transform the world of percepts without interrupting its coherence in natural law. Footnote: only a superficial view could see in the use of the word faculty here and in other passages a return to an older psychology's teaching of soul faculties. Connecting it with what was said on pages 88 and 89 yields the exact meaning of the word. End of footnote. The capacity to transform the world of percepts is moral technique. It is learnable in the sense that any knowledge is learnable. Generally, people are better equipped to find concepts for the world that is already finished than to determine productively out of their imagination future, not yet existent, actions. Therefore, those without moral imagination may well receive the moral mental pictures of other people and skillfully work them into reality. The reverse can also occur. People with moral imagination can lack technical skill and may have to make use of others to realize their mental pictures. Insofar as knowledge of the objects within our field of action is necessary for moral action, our actions are based upon this kind of knowledge. What is relevant here are natural laws. We are dealing with natural science, not with ethics. Moral imagination and the moral capacity for ideas can become objects of knowledge only after an individual has produced them. By then, they no longer regulate life. They have already regulated it. They can be regarded as effective causes, like any others. They are purposes only for the subject. Hence, we deal with them as with a natural history of moral ideas. Apart from this, there can be no science of ethical norms. Some people have tried to retain the normative character of moral laws, at least to the extent that they have understood ethics as if it were analogous to dietetics. Dietetics derives general rules from the organism's requirements for life, so as then to affect the body on the basis of these rules. Footnote: C.F. Paulsen, System der Ethik, System of Ethics, 1889. Friedrich Paulsen was a German philosopher, educator, and professor who elaborated a theory of panpsychism and wrote on Kant in the History of German Education. End of footnote. But the comparison between ethics and dietetics is false, because our moral life cannot be compared with the life of the organism. The organism's activity exists without any contribution on our part. We find its laws already present in the world. Hence, we can seek the laws and apply those that we have found. But moral laws are first created by us. Before they are created, we cannot apply them. The error arises because moral laws are not created at each moment with a new content, but are inherited. Thus, moral laws inherited from one's ancestors appear to be given, like the natural laws of the organism, but they are in no way applied by a later generation with the same legitimacy as the rules of diet. For moral laws deal with the individual, and not, like natural law, with an example of a species. I, as an organism, am just such an example of a species. I will live according to nature if I apply the natural laws of the species to my particular case. But as a moral being, I am an individual, and have laws of my very own. Footnote: when Paulsen says, quote, different natural predispositions and life conditions require both a different corporeal diet and a different spiritual moral diet, unquote, he is quite close to the right understanding, yet he misses the decisive point. To the extent that I am an individual, I do not need a diet. Dietetics is the art of bringing the particular example into harmony with general laws. But as an individual, I am not an example of a species, end footnote. The view presented here seems to contradict the fundamental teaching of modern natural science known as the theory of evolution, but it only seems to be so. People understand evolution to mean the real development, according to natural laws, of what is later from what was earlier. People understand evolution in the organic world to mean that later, more perfect organic forms are real descendants of earlier, more imperfect forms, and developed from them according to natural laws. Adherents of the theory of organic evolution must actually imagine that there was once a time on Earth when a being, if it were present as an observer endowed with a sufficiently long lifespan, could have followed with its own eyes the gradual development of reptiles from proto-amniotes. In the same way, evolutionists imagine that a being, if it could have remained in an appropriate spot in the world ether during that infinitely long time, could have observed the development of the solar system out of the Kant-Laplace primordial nebula. In order to picture things in this way, however, the nature of the proto-amniotes, like the Kant-Laplace primordial nebula, would have to be thought of differently than materialists think of them. But that is irrelevant here. Evolutionists could never claim that without having ever seen a reptile, they could derive the concept of reptiles, with all their features, from the concept of proto-amniotes. Nor can the solar system be derived from the concept of the Kant-Laplace primordial nebula, if that concept is understood to be directly determined only by the percept of the primordial nebula. In other words, if they think consistently, evolutionists must assert that later phases of evolution really follow from earlier ones, and that if we have the concept of the imperfect and that of the perfect given to us, we will be able to see the connection. But on no account can evolutionists affirm that the concept attained from the earlier is sufficient to develop the concept of the later from it. It follows that while ethicists can certainly see the connection between earlier and later moral concepts, not even a single new moral idea can be drawn forth from earlier ones. As moral beings, individuals produce their own content. For an ethicist, this content is just as much a given as reptiles are a given for the natural scientist. Reptiles develop from protoamniotes, but natural scientists cannot get the concept of reptiles out of the concept of protoamniotes. Later moral ideas develop from earlier ones, but ethicists cannot draw forth the ethical concepts of later cultural epochs from those of earlier epochs. The confusion arises because as natural scientists, we already have the facts before us and afterward investigate them cognitively. While for ethical action we must ourselves first create the facts that we cognize afterward, in the evolutionary process of the ethical world order, we accomplish something that on a lower level is accomplished by nature. We alter something perceptible. Thus, initially, the ethical norm cannot be cognized like a natural law. Rather, it must be created. Only once it is present can it become the object of cognition. But can we not measure the new against the old? Are not all of us forced to measure what we produce by our moral imagination against received ethical teachings? If we are to be ethically productive, this is as absurd as if we were to measure a new natural form against an old one and say reptiles are an unjustifiable pathological form because they do not match proto-amniotes. Thus, ethical individualism does not contradict the theory of evolution when it is properly understood, but follows directly from it. Haeckel's genealogical tree, running from protozoa to human beings as organic beings, ought to be traceable, without interrupting natural law or breaking the uniformity of evolution, right up to the individual as an ethical being in a specific sense. Footnote: Ernst Heinrich Philipp August Haeckel, 1834-1919, German biologist and philosopher, the first German advocate of Darwin's theory of evolution. Haeckel formulated the famous dictum, quote, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, unquote. Haeckel was the first to draw up a genealogical tree, relating all the various orders of animals, and proposed that all life was a unity, originating in crystals and evolving to humanity, end of footnote. But nowhere could we derive the nature of a subsequent species from the nature of an ancestral species. It is true that an individual's ethical ideas evolve from those of his or her predecessors, but it is equally true that individuals are ethically sterile if they lack moral ideas of their own. The same ethical individualism that I have developed on the basis of the preceding views could also be derived from the theory of evolution. The final conviction would be the same, only the path by which it was attained would be different. To the theory of evolution, the emergence of completely new ethical ideas from moral imagination is no more amazing than the development of a new animal species from an old one. But as a monistic worldview, evolutionary theory must reject, in ethics, as in science, every merely inferred, otherworldly, metaphysical influence that cannot be experienced conceptually. In so doing, it is following the same principle as when it seeks causes of new organic forms, without appeal to the interference of an otherworldly being, who, by supernatural influence, summons each new species according to a new creative thought. Just as monism cannot employ supernatural creative thoughts to explain living creatures, so likewise it cannot derive the ethical order of the world from causes lying outside the experienceable world. For monism, the moral essence of someone's will is never fully explained by tracing it back to some continuous supernatural influence on ethical life, parenthesis, divine world rule from without, parenthesis, to a specific temporal revelation, parenthesis, transmission of the Ten Commandments, parenthesis, or to the appearance of God on earth, Christ. What happens in a human being and to a human being by means of these becomes ethical only if it is appropriated in human experience by individuals who make it their own. For monism, ethical processes are products of the world like everything else that exists, and their causes must be sought in the world, that is to say, in human beings, because humans are the bearers of morality. Thus, ethical individualism becomes the pinnacle of the edifice that Darwin and Haeckel sought to build for natural science. It is a spiritualized evolutionary theory transferred to moral life. Those who narrow-mindedly confine the concept of what is natural to an arbitrarily limited region easily reach the point of not being able to find any room there for free individual action. Consistent, systematic evolutionists cannot fall into any such narrow-mindedness. They cannot close the natural path of evolution with the apes and then give humanity a supernatural origin. Evolutionists must seek the spirit too, in nature, even in the search for natural human ancestors. They cannot stop at human organic processes, finding those alone to be natural. They must also regard the morally free life as a spiritual continuation of organic life. According to their fundamental principles, theorists of evolution can claim only that present ethical behavior follows from other kinds of occurrences in the world. To characterize an action, for instance, to define it as free, must be left to immediate observation of the action itself. After all, evolutionists also claim only that humans evolved from non-human ancestors. What humans are actually like must be ascertained through observation of human beings themselves. The results of such observation cannot come into conflict with a properly understood history of evolution. Only the claim that these results were such as to preclude a natural world order could not be aligned with the current trend of natural science. Footnote, it is quite proper that we speak of thoughts, ethical ideas, as objects of observation. For even if the products of thinking do not enter into consciousness during thought activity, they can still become the object of observation afterward. It is in this way that we have been able to characterize human action. End of footnote. Ethical individualism has nothing to fear from natural science that understands itself. Observation shows that freedom is characteristic of the perfected form of human action. This freedom must be ascribed to the human will insofar as the will realizes pure conceptual intuitions. For these intuitions do not result from necessity working upon them from without. They are self-sustaining. We feel the action to be free when we find that it is the image of such an ideal intuition. The freedom of an action lies in this characteristic. From this standpoint, what can be said about the distinction made in chapter 1 between the two sentences, quote, to be free means to be able to do what one wills, unquote, and, quote, the real meaning of the dogma of free will is to be able to desire or not desire as one pleases, unquote. Question. Hemmerling based his view of free will precisely on this distinction, describing the first of these as correct and the second as an absurd tautology. He says, quote, I can do what I will, but to say that I can will what I will is an empty tautology, unquote. Whether I do transform into reality what I will, that is, what I have intended as the idea of my action, depends on outer circumstances and on my technical skill. To be free means to be able on my own, through moral imagination, to determine the mental pictures, motives, underlying an action. Freedom is impossible if something outside myself, whether a mechanical process or a merely inferred otherworldly God, determines my moral mental pictures. Therefore, I am free only when I produce these mental pictures myself, not merely when I can carry out motives that another has placed within me. Free beings are those who can will what they themselves hold to be right. Those who do something other than what they want must be driven to it through motives that do not lie within them. They are acting unfreely. To choose to will or want what I consider right or not right, therefore, means to choose to be free or unfree. But this, naturally, is just as absurd as to see freedom in the capacity to do what one has to will. Yet this is exactly what Hemmerling claims when he says that it is perfectly clear that the will is always determined by motives, but it is absurd to say that it is therefore unfree. For we can neither wish for nor think of a greater freedom of the will than for it to realize itself according to its own strength and determination. But we can wish for a greater freedom, and only then is it true freedom, namely to determine for ourselves the motive of our will. Under certain circumstances, we can be induced to refrain from what we want to do, to allow ourselves to be told what we ought to do, that is, to want what others and not we ourselves consider to be right. To this we submit only to the extent that we do not feel free. Outer forces can prevent me from doing what I will. In that case, they simply condemn me to inaction or to unfreedom. Only if they subjugate my spirit, drive my motives from my head, and replace them with their own, only then do they really intend to make me unfree. This is why the Church is not merely against actions, but particularly against impure thoughts, the motives for my actions. The Church makes me unfree when it sees as impure all motives that it has not itself decreed. A church or any other community creates unfreedom when its priests or teachers turn themselves into keepers of conscience, so that the faithful in the confessional must take the motives for their actions from them. That is the end of chapter 12, the addendum to the new edition, 1918. This discussion of human will shows what human beings can experience in their actions, so that through this experience they arrive at the awareness, quote, my will is free, unquote. It is especially significant that the justification for calling a will free comes from the experience that a conceptual intuition realizes itself in the will. This can result only from observation, and it does so only when human willing observes itself in a stream of development whose aim is precisely to make possible willing carried by purely conceptual intuition. This is achievable because in conceptual intuition, nothing but its own self-based essence is at work. Whenever such an intuition is present in human consciousness, it has not developed from the processes of the organism. Rather, organic activity has withdrawn to make room for conceptual activity. If I observe willing that is the image of an intuition, then all organic necessary activity has withdrawn from that willing. The will is free. Such freedom of will cannot be observed by someone unable to see that free willing consists in the fact that the necessary activity of the human organism is first numbed and suppressed by the intuitive element, and then replaced by the spiritual activity of the idea-filled will. Only someone who cannot make this observation of the twofold nature of a free act of will believes that all willing is unfree. Anyone who can make the observation struggles through to the insight that human beings are unfree to the extent that they cannot complete the process of restraining the organic activity, but that such unfreedom strives toward freedom, which is in no way an abstract ideal, but a guiding power inherent in human nature. Human beings are free to the extent that they can realize in their willing the same mood of soul that lives in them when they are conscious of forming purely conceptual spiritual intuitions. That's the end of chapter 12 and the end of this reading, of this section.